Welcome to episode 40 of the Corporate Real Estate Insider Podcast. We are excited to deliver a great episode today, covering a lot of different topics from office space in New York to industrial real estate nationally. But starting us off, Brian is in his new studio and his new office today. Let's go to Brian.
Yeah, I think I want to start off with a quick update that I think, you know, after 40 episodes or 39 episodes, we've all kind of created a persona on the podcast. And something I just learned this morning that others may find interesting as well is that John is at plays the harmonica and just celebrated his birthday and was on stage for, John, how many songs? A couple dozen songs?
18 songs.
Yeah, that's, you know, I don't know if others share this, but I would never have thought this knowing just by listening to the podcast that you're a, you know, professional harmonica player on the side. So interesting.
I am not that. I did get up there. I risked embarrassment and I think I'm okay.
Yeah. Happy birthday. And that's pretty cool. Hopefully you share it on some social media, some personal social media, not, you know, not the podcast social media, but, to jump into what people do want to talk about is real estate. And I want to bring you back to an episode I talked about a few months ago where we had kind of talked about the challenges and some of the risks of subleasing. And I had told a story about one of our clients who had a sublandlord who was a publicly traded company that had, you know, okay financials at the time of doing the deal. It unfortunately go in, get into financial trouble and default on their sub, on their lease, which then, and then in turn, put my client at a point where they needed to find a new space. And to update our listeners on that, the client was actually us, our firm, our team was, at the, if anyone knows Boston, we were at the John Hancock building, which was 200 Clarendon. It's owned by Boston Properties. And we were in a sublease that, unfortunately, the sublandlord went bankrupt. And, you know, we were forced very quickly to have to pivot and find a new home. And I would tell you, first off, that Boston Properties was exceptional to work with. The space, we were getting it at a significant discount. And, you know, it's not only probably the nicest piece of space that any real estate firm in the city would work at, it's some of the nicest space that any firm, period, had worked at in the city. So when they got the space back, they were happy to take it back from this particular tenant and, you know, increase the rent by 20 or 30%. And very quickly, we're hearing that they have some interest already from other tenants on the floor that are, you know, in a position to pay those types of rents. Us, unfortunately, in this business, we, you know, that's not in line with how we view real estate for our office. So we quickly pivoted, but Boston Properties did allow us through a 90-day extension directly to soften the, you know, soften the edges and be able to get a new space up and running. And we moved over to the Seaport, which is also one of the nicest areas and one of the nicest buildings, in a sublease from Gunderson Dittmer. And, you know, it's just one of those challenges that sublease space on the market today is trading at a significant discount to direct space. A lot of it, and this is especially true in New England with the life science industry, a lot of it is under leases for companies that are not in the greatest financial position. So it's a challenge in a market where you may have a great opportunity to take space at a discount, but you're putting some risks on your operations and on the firm if, you know, if there is an issue with the sublandlord. Us being in the business and having, you know, our project management team and our entire company be really aligned with being able to do this very quickly, we knew we could execute on a move and find new space and sign a lease very quickly. So we were able to mitigate a lot of the risks, but other operations that have more fixed assets in the space have a more challenging requirement to solve in the market. Just have to be aware of that when you're assessing subleases, especially today here in New England for any industry, but specifically the life science industry, where, you know, there could be over 100 subleases on the market, and many of those companies are going to run out of funding at some time in the near future. But we're happy to report today is officially day two in the new office, the new studio, the new background. Unfortunately, I can't open the blinds because you'd see a glare behind me, but, you know, we're right on the water. It's beautiful space, and we're pretty excited about it.
Brian Connolly doesn't pay full price. So when those, you know, rents go from 50% off sublease rents to, you know, 30% above what the prior market was and already the most expensive building, he finds another amazing, beautiful sublease and he moves. Good points. I think the reality is that most companies that have generally pretty like typical usage of office space, right? The vast majority of our offices our brokers are in private offices, our operational team are generally in workstations, and there's frankly a lot of space like that in a lot of markets, and no sense in, you know, overpaying by what would effectively be probably three times when you can go to comparable space, so long as you have the technical capability and the bandwidth to be able to execute on a relocation in short order. A lot of companies just simply cannot deal with a relocation in 90 days. And then the risk of doing a sublease with a potentially, a sublandlord that may have a going concern, which of course we knew when we, you know, went and, you know, signed that sublease, we knew there was a chance. We were hoping this wouldn't happen, but we knew that there was a chance. So anyways, nice work. If only our audience could see your, beautiful background. But I mean, I did see before we hopped on that you have a motorized shade. These back here, these are manual. I'm having to go back there and do that myself. So,
yeah, they did not spare any expense. This is expansion space for a world-class law firm that it's some of the nicest space with motorized shades and just really cool finishes. So we got exceptionally lucky again, as you said, in a market where they took additional space, built it out, and thought they were going to continue to grow, and they are. It's just probably not using space at the same clip they were before, and like everybody, they had an opportunity to sublease a big chunk of it, so it worked out really well.
Some defensive expansion from them is to our benefit, so we'll take it.
Certainly will.
Okay, so shifting gears, let's talk a little bit about industrial real estate. Going back to the beginning of the year, this is probably, you know, episode like late 20s, something like that. We talked a lot about what's going on in the industrial real estate market, both nationally, but we talked a little bit more specifically, or at least I did, about what's going on in Southern California, which is obviously one of the largest industrial markets in the country, certainly one of the most expensive industrial markets in the entire country. And we just wanted to do a little, you know, mid-year update, like what's actually happening, what's going on. This is something that I think is being talked about at a general level, at least in the real estate community, but we have not seen it widely reported on. So I want to run through some really high level stuff around what's going on and then bring in, you know, Brian, Owen, and John to have a bit of a discussion around, based on these updates, based on everything that's happened, how are we going to adjust our prior forecasts? To remind everyone before we go in, we generally had mixed views that range from the industrial market's going to go down to more or less it's going to stay the same. No one anticipated that the market would increase, and as everyone is probably aware, the market has not increased. So generally we were accurate. Some of us were more accurate than others, but jumping into the stats. So Los Angeles has had 9 consecutive quarters of shrinking occupancy for industrial real estate, right? That's now, you know, over 2 years straight of every quarter, the industrial market has gotten worse. Vacancy has gone from being below 2% to being over 5%. And a lot of people may say, hey, look, 5% is still pretty low vacancy, especially when compared to other industrial markets that are less supply constrained compared to Southern California around the country. The reality is, and the headline here really should be, there's 2.5 times more industrial space on the market today than there was just 2 years ago. That's insane. I mean, you think about pricing power, that's essentially flooding the market with additional supply. And this market has generally been in that 2-3% range for many years, right? So this is really significant. And then I think most notably, 60% of the 12 million square feet of industrial real estate that is either under construction now or was delivered after 2023 is still available for lease. So you're seeing all these, you know, really expensive new construction, Class A plus warehouse buildings that are delivering. Over half of them have not been leased, right? And most of these developers, when they started building, had the expectation that they would have zero downtime, or maybe they would pro forma model 1 or 2 or 3 months of downtime, and that's it. That's the level of demand that existed for industrial real estate. Shifting to the Inland Empire, vacancy has gone from 1.2% 2 years ago, like summer of 2022, to 7.8% today. So you have like a 6.5-7 times increase in the amount of vacant industrial space that exists in the Inland Empire. What's so interesting about the Inland Empire in particular is that over that 24-month period, there has been about 57 million square feet of space that has been constructed and delivered, right? So when you actually factor in like what's the amount of space that's vacant today compared to 2 years ago, the 1.2 to 7.8%, that was 8 million square feet of vacant space in July of 2022. And today there's 60 million square feet of vacant space. But what's so interesting is that if you look at the new construction numbers of how much product has actually been delivered, it's almost exactly equal to the amount of vacant space that there is. So you can make an argument that the Inland Empire industrial market would more or less be 100% leased without much excess space, without much, you know, excess demand, if none of these buildings had been built over the last 2 years. I mean, building 57 million square feet of space is an insane amount of space to be built, and sort of shows that a lot of these industrial real estate pullbacks, at least historically, a lot of the pain is caused by excess development and less so a pullback in fundamentals. Like, of course, imports for Southern California are below pre-pandemic levels. They're 5 to 10% lower than 2017 to 2019 right now. Of course, that has a negative impact. But the real negative impact is because of the massive amount of building by, you know, all these industrial property developers. The last thing I wanted to mention is that, by contrast, Orange County has performed much better than Los Angeles and the Inland Empire. I would argue that this is mostly because of the supply constraints that exist. Orange County, more supply constrained than Los Angeles. Los Angeles, more supply constrained than the Inland Empire. So in Orange County, you've seen vacancy go from 1.8 to 4.3%. And you have to say, okay, well, why has that happened? There's just not that many developable sites in Orange County that can actually deliver. And the cost of that land is usually high enough that a lot of times the new product that is being delivered in Orange County are build-to-suits that probably wouldn't get built on a speculative basis, or at least as consistently on a speculative basis, because the rents are so high, and usually it's, you know, due to some strategic reason a company wants to be there. So anyways, enough of the you know, stats and vacancy percentages. I'm curious what you all think. We were pretty right. Of course, we haven't totally talked about rents, which we'll talk about in a minute. But given the fundamentals, I think we can all agree that, like, one, we know that rents have gone down. We've talked about that over the last couple of months. But two, do we feel that rents have gone down in a way that is consistent with the fundamentals? Should rents go down more? Where is the remainder of 2024 and 2025 bring us in terms of the health of the industrial real estate market in Southern California, but also more broadly nationally? What do you all think is going to happen?
Yeah, I think it's indicative of what was the time we're in, right? So there was over 2 billion square feet of industrial real estate delivered in the cycle, in the last 4 years during the cycle. Construction starts are off by about 50% last time I checked. So you're seeing all the space delivered, just like you were referencing in the Inland Empire. There's no new product being built right now. Nothing coming out of the ground because demand is not there and financing is drying up. I think developers were hoping that the absorption of the existing product that was being built would get absorbed. And if you look at a lot of the the graphs on where they thought the market was going. And I think we kind of fell into this maybe slightly better than this prediction, but they had thought it would kind of level off. A lot of the space that was in the market would get absorbed, and then rents would start spiking again because there's nothing being built and delivered over the next, 12, 24, 36 months because construction starts are off. Well, that whole model, I think, just went out the window because demand has dried up so significantly and you're seeing massive amounts of space sitting on the market. So in my opinion, it's rents will fall to meet the market in a lot of different ways. The newest product that has a higher basis is going to sit for longer and people are going to have to pay out. And when companies absorb the space that can be more elastic with market conditions, that have better financing, that haven't been built as recently, are able to absorb that space, then you're going to see tenants again have to go back to these newer buildings that are being delivered at a much higher rent. So I think the market's going to bifurcate more directly than it has been, because when supply is low, you got to take what you can get. I think we'll see, just like we're seeing in the office sector, a stronger bifurcation in the market where the newest product at the highest rents are going to sit in other locations that have the ability to meet the market based on current demand and current vacancy levels, is where all the activity is going to sit. So as long as the product meets their needs. But I think that product is really going to have an opportunity to lease quicker because they can be more receptive to these changing market conditions.
Yeah, I think you're going to definitely see rents start to fall, in my opinion. It's actually no surprise to me that they haven't, because if you look back historically, rents typically lag vacancy, meaning that when vacancy starts to spike, rents don't start to fall immediately. It takes time. Keep in mind, as anyone out there that's listening has been a tenant that's leased space, maybe you're a landlord or a leasing agent or you're a broker, negotiations for contracts and leases can take some time. And so those alone, when those, if and when those comps hit the market, typically there's a reflection of vacancy changes in those rental rates. But keep in mind, those terms that were part of the letter of intent may have been negotiated 1 to sometimes, gosh, as much as, 4 to 6 months ago. Also, there's this thing called inertia, and landlords are sometimes very reluctant to quickly reduce rental rates when they hear the market is changing, specifically in this case, as we're talking about rents rising or vacancy rising. There's no need sometimes for some landlords to react quickly. Sometimes landlords have a portfolio that might be 95% leased, and so they may take the position that, hey, I don't need to capitulate to the market. I'm already very well stabilized. I don't have any exposure in my portfolio for the next few years. I'll let other landlords, drop their rates, and I'm going to kind of hold firm, because if I lease the space or not, not that big of a deal for me. Whereas somebody who has a lot of vacancy might be more apt to, adjust their rental rates. There are also some broader economic implications at play here, where we might be seeing, interest rates fall, which might be turning things around. So there could be some landlords that are hopeful for the future and are just a little bit reluctant to make any changes now, because it's a lot harder to, drop rates and then try and raise them, shortly thereafter, then say hold and just see how things play out and take it deal by deal. And if someone comes along, that you really want, maybe you reach for that transaction, but maybe not. And so I just think there's a lot that has to happen before you start to see everyone. When I say everyone, I mean the broader market in terms of the landlords and their brokers capitulating lower rents. But I think in the scheme of things, it's almost inevitable at this point, especially if we see vacancy continuing to rise. But it just sometimes takes time, sometimes as much as 6 months.
It's just a good old-fashioned overbuilding cycle. And we all saw it coming, and it happens again and again and again. I mean, you had vacancy rates, as you were speaking to, of 1%, 2%, a white-hot industrial market. And of course, what are developers and builders going to do in that kind of a market? They're going to develop. They're going to build. Of course they are. They're going to find the land and find a way to make it pencil. So, and then of course things cool. It never seems like it when you're in the middle of the white hot market, like, ooh, when are things going to slow down? I don't see it coming. And all of a sudden it comes every time. There will be a cycle. Bank on it. And it happened. And it caught some folks who were building, you know, it's hard to turn off those construction projects. You've already designed the building. You've gotten the permits. You're underway. You got your financing. You proceed. So we end up with more buildings on the market and increasing vacancy and increasing supply. It's a good old-fashioned overbuilding cycle. It's going to happen again and again and again. And then the only other thing I will add to the conversation, this idea to remember and to realize that effective rents fall first, right? We talk about falling rents. The contract rate is the last thing they want to move because, of course, building value is based on that. The perform is based on that. The financing was based on that. And so what you're going to see is increasing concessions. We're already seeing that. That's the first thing. They're quick to offer free rent, increasing TI packages, greater flexibility on lease terms. The effective rent is going to fall first. And whether it continues to remain soft and force landlords to compete on contract rental rate, that's what's going to happen next. And how far that goes, we'll have to see. Just to remind us all, effective rents are going to fall first. And that's still great for the tenants who are mostly focused on cash flow and how much rent am I really spending over time.
So thinking back to our conversation in January, one of the things that we talked specifically about was that perhaps the industrial real estate market wouldn't have rents go down because there were a lot of major developers that were buffering construction, right? Prologis came out very early on. I believe this happened in late 2023, essentially saying, hey, we're going to dramatically slow down our development pipeline, basically only build on a, you know, committed build-to-suit basis with a lease in hand. You saw Link Logistics slow down, you know, seriously in their, you know, new construction development of the sites that they control. You saw the acquisition of industrial developers of buying land sites fall to basically zero or close to zero, unless it was, again, a build-to-suit. And there was conversations on this podcast saying, well, hey, wait a minute, if everyone stops building, then we may have this gap that similarly existed in COVID when everyone stopped building for a couple months there just to see what would happen. And I'm talking like March, April, May of when the sky was falling. No one knew that there was going to be how long it would be and what would happen, interest rates and the shift to e-commerce, how sustainable it was and all that. And that was one of the contributing factors to prices surging, right? Prices can get out of control when there's limited supply. And if COVID never happened, and if those same factors that we talked about on the podcast that all drove industrial rents to these crazy highs, like insanely low vacancy, a shift to e-commerce, a lot higher like fulfillment and like stocking rates that inventory held like here in Southern California or in the US versus just in time because the supply chain was so disrupted. When you actually think about all of those things, right? Pricing would have never gotten to where it is today without that. But now that pricing did get there, it's very hard to unwind. Like we're not going to see the unwinding of like 30, 40, 50% year over year increases in industrial real estate rents that happen in some markets around the country. Rents have fallen probably by, I mean, this is, I'm painting with a broad brush here, but rents have fallen by probably 20% in Southern California. That doesn't even put a dent into the 30, 40, 50% year over year increases that we saw for several years, right? So I think over the long run, on like a 10-year projected timeline, the thing that actually is most healthy for industrial real estate is to prevent any periods of extreme supply constraints, because those periods of extreme supply constraint contribute to rapid increases in prices that really aren't justified otherwise. And then they never get unwound. And we're in a position where I don't think that the industrial real estate rents are going to be unwound very easily. Should they? Okay, maybe. But if they really were unwound in the way that, you know, perhaps they should, then basically anyone that bought a building since COVID would be dramatically underwater. Or the rents that they maybe have now, the forecast would be that they wouldn't be able to get them on renewal, which I unfortunately don't think is the case. I think these rents are unfortunately quite sticky.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the Prologis came out with that that statement, and I think you're right. I think it was towards the end of 23. And then their first quarter earnings, I remember reading about this, their first quarter earnings in 24, they had very strong revenue growth, strong earnings, but they revised their outlook for the market. And they warned, I think that it could be as strong as saying that, they warned that there's a slowing industrial sector, right? So the big players knew this was coming. They could see it in the demand. They could see it in their numbers. They first retrench and say, we're only doing built-to-suits. We're not doing any more speculative development. Second, they start to warn of softness in the marketplace. And now we're into the second quarter and we're here. It's certainly proving itself out. I think your point, it all depends on how much, like, you can solve the supply constraints in two ways: build more or demand less. And I think for the longest time, and where we're at right now, is they were building and all of a sudden the demand dropped off. So it widened the gap and it created this huge opportunity in the marketplace for the vacancy to skyrocket in real terms. I think will rents retrench? I think people were saying the same thing about the office sector. Now, this is the worst office market that's ever existed, I think, in U.S. history, right? So is industrial going to get there? But probably not. But I think, I'm just thinking about the market here. There's an 800,000 square foot warehouse was built in a location that is not optimal in New England here. And I won't say who built it or where it is, because it's vacant and they probably wouldn't like me saying that. But, at a time when the market was very tight, it would lease. Well, now there's much better options on better transit locations, more centrally located. And I would hate to own this building, right? So if you start to lump in stuff built in the Inland Empire, it's in the Inland Empire. It's people are there because they know they want to be there. Is that going to lease eventually? Yes. But I think developers took cheap money, assembled sites, and put buildings where they shouldn't be. And I would suspect that took place all over the country. And are those buildings going to lease? Who knows, right? They're certainly not going to lease first. And users are going to demand a pretty significant discount. So you're going to see certain outliers really have to work, or lenders have to take buildings back to be able to lease them. I bet you it's coming. I do, because demand has slowed so significantly with cost pressures across all industries that companies are looking at this very differently. I was in a meeting a couple weeks ago with someone who has, tens of millions of square feet of warehouse space along the West Coast. And the answer was, we need to save money. It's not, how do we get more efficient? How do we grow more efficiently? How do we build a network that supplies our customers better? How do we get closer to our end users? Anything. It's, we need to save money and we need to do it now. And that's it. And this is a major, major medical device company. It's an industry that you would think is somewhat resilient to cycles, and it is not in this case. So I think a lot of this is cyclical, but I think the cost pressures are front and center right now for users. They're going to allow them to reduce their footprints, even if it impacts downstream.
So let me see if I can paint this metaphor. It occurs to me this is the way markets work. Did you ever have an old analog thermometer outside, and it would sort of measure min and max? There's these little bars that it pushes up and pushes down, right? In the max, it pushes the bar up, and then as the temperatures come down, the bar doesn't come down. Okay, that's kind of the way contract rates work. Like industrial rents, are climbing, and they get to $1.50 triple net monthly rents. And then maybe there's a soft market, and rents don't come down. Effective rents come down. These concessions start increasing, but they're trying to hold on to that $1.50 until the next cycle can pick up again and start to push that thing up to $1.75. or maybe in the current cycle, we got to $2 a square foot triple net monthly for industrial rents, crazy high. But that's sort of this max bar that's not going to come back down. They're going to play games with effective rents, wait for the next boom cycle that'll then push the new high watermark for industrial rents. What do you think?
I think it dates you that those thermometers probably retired like, I don't know, 30 years ago or something. But
I'm like, what is this guy talking about? I got a weather app on my phone. Like, what's going on, John?
We did say I just had a birthday, so yeah. I saw no one. Owen was nodding. Is it, you seem?
I was nodding just because I was like, I use my phone, so yeah.
I mean, John knows about thermometers. He knows about harmonicas. This is a man with diverse interests and talents. Look, I think you're right. I think that as the market gets pushed up to new highs, that not necessarily that it doesn't come down, these alleged thermometers from the Renaissance period or something. But I agree. Once it gets pushed up, I think it's very hard for rents to come down back to. I think a new baseline is established, and that you see rents generally fall by 20%, 30%, 40%, but you don't see a full reset. I mean, people forget that if you have a 30%, 40% compounding for 3 years, that you effectively have doubled the rents when you consider the compound effect of interest. Obviously, more if a longer period of time. I think for me, I think one of the most interesting ways to think about the real estate market as a whole is when it comes to office space, you have the ultra premium product that's outperforming because generally that is supply constrained and you can't make any more of it, right? Because it just doesn't make sense to construct these buildings with how high construction costs are and what the market is in general. But on the industrial side, you have the inverse problem, right? Like one of the things that is kind of funny to think about is that when you get into hospitality and you start thinking about motels, right? Generally, the motels that you would want to own now are probably the motels that are the oldest, that have the lowest basis, that were constructed the least expensively, because you're trying to access this cheapest possible product in the market, right? If you're staying in a motel, then it's not like you're trying to stay at the Four Seasons or Ritz-Carlton. It's like the people that are staying there are looking for somewhere to sleep and they want to do it at the lowest cost possible. Well, very inexpensive product is supply constrained because you can't rebuild it at today's cost on any land or anything like that and deliver a product with a basis that's low enough to offer the same price as a 50-year-old motel. The same thing exists in industrial real estate. If you're going to build a building today, you're going to build it to Class A standards on generally expensive land. You're going to deliver probably a 36 to 40 foot clear height building with ESFR sprinklers and LED lighting and really functional dock loading. It's probably a cross dock building, right? Everyone sort of can picture what that Class A industrial building is today, but those buildings are generally the most expensive. And if there is a Class A building of 2010 or even 2005 standards, that's probably 30 to 36 foot clear, that probably has had a sprinkler upgrade, that probably still has functional loading, that can be updated with minor adjustments, and that building's 30 or 40% less expensive, companies are generally going to pick that building every single time. So it's a tale of two office products. Class A is outperforming in office because it's supply constrained. And then the call it Class B plus or A minus in industrial is outperforming because you can't really create more of it at the same price.
I think we're agreeing on this, Tucker. I think the last time we talked industrial, you and I were not in alignment, but this is where I was going as well, and well said and well articulated. I think the challenge for our clients in industrial is that pricing pressure, right? So if you're in a space, it's very difficult to get an owner to, even in that Class B plus, A minus type product, it's difficult to get an owner to accept where the market is if it's below that accelerated or increased rent over whatever term, which requires them to need to move, right? Or at least get into the marketplace. And my experience with industrial owners, you kind of have to move. It's very difficult to get them to reset costs when all of the news for the last, what, 5-7 years has been about these massive increases in rents, and many of them have been, you know, sitting on the sidelines waiting for leases to expire that were signed 5 or 10 years ago to be able to reset rents to market. And those are built either into the pricing of transactions when you do probability to renew, or just built into the psyche of the owner waiting for your lease to expire. And now the market is starting to pull back. It's very difficult for them, unless you move to vacancy, to accept that it's not where they think it was when they looked at it. It's like the mental hurdle of, you know, when you put your house on the market today, it might be still worth a lot more than you paid for it, but it could be worth 5%, 4%, 10% less than the peak. And people still want to price it at the peak, right? They're just not willing to mentally accept. And that's, I think, the psyche you have with a lot of these industrial owners right now, is that they're just not willing to accept that the market is pulling back. It's not bad enough yet, especially when occupancy for most of these owners are very high. So the opportunity is going to be in relocation. And it's not going to be, unfortunately, in my opinion, it's not going to be in, you know, playing the game to relocate yet. That'll come. But I think now is you physically have to pick up and move to a building and to get the value that you're talking about, has been my experience so far.
Yeah, it's really challenging to get landlords to lower prices when they think that they have a captive tenant. I just finished a transaction maybe 2 weeks ago where the company had started talking to a large industrial user, 100,000-ish square feet, in Southern California, had gone and talked to their landlord. Landlord had proposed a renewal rate of over $2 a square foot for them to stay per month on a triple net basis. And they were shocked. Oh my gosh, this is unacceptable. This is crazy. They hadn't really investigated the market. They engaged our team. We started working with them. We actually ended up renewing their lease just below $1.50 a square foot, which was better than what I would have expected when we started the transaction. But we found another building that was nearby that had been vacant for a little bit that was of similar quality. We were going to have to incur move costs and some like construction costs above the tenant improvement allowance that was provided. But we had a, you know, 6 month payback on those investments based on the, you know, like 70 cents a square foot a month arbitrage that we were going to get. And we're like, hey, we're leaving. And then they came back and said, no, you're not. We'll essentially match the deal. But it's sort of a shame that you have to literally leave or say that you're going to leave, which is incredibly risky if you're not, if that's like not true, probably not recommended unless in, you know, very extreme circumstances. But yeah, I mean, if they had a vacant building and they had a new tenant, they'd give them that price. But if they've got an existing tenant, then the price is different. And a lot of times it's 20 to 30% more expensive right now in industrial real estate. And that is unfair and a shame. And I wish it weren't that way, but it is. And the more tenants that understand that, the faster the market price will be driven to equilibrium, which is lower than where landlords think it is today, at least for occupied buildings.
So let me ask you a question, all of you. If you're one of our clients and you're sitting there and you're saying, okay, I've got X number of leases, this is more of a portfolio play, but I've got X number of leases, I've got expirations ranging from 25, 26, 27, is now the right time to start the conversations to be able to capture the softness in the market? Or am I better off doing that? Now, some you have to deal with, but the ones that are more strategic in nature, am I better off doing that in a year from now or 6 months from now than today? Or is it better to be one of the first doing it to try to be ahead of the curve in terms of where the market's going and start these conversations now? Or do we just sit on the sidelines and wait?
I think it's and I don't mean to, you know, give a softball type of answer, but I think it's a case-by-case basis, because it's not only predicated on what market you're in, because some markets are performing better than others, of course, but I think it's also a matter of, like, in those situations, is that location that you're talking about within the portfolio or locations, is that one that is set to move because they need more or less space, or is that one set that is set to renew confidentially, of course, where your client says they don't want to move? I will say, you know, there was a case where I just did a transaction about 2 months ago where we approached the landlord early, suggesting, you know, we would be willing to entertain some sort of a transaction, you know, if we could come to terms now versus later. It expired 2 years from now. And landlord was kind of like, nah, not interested. And so we made no emotional decision about it. We just said, okay, fine, great. We'll just kind of hang tight. And when we're about a year out, we'll start the process. Well, surprisingly, you know, 60 days goes by. We had gone dark on the landlord. They came back to us and said, well, hey, I want to circle back on the conversation we had 2 months ago. Would you guys still be willing to entertain something today? And the answer was like, sure, we'd be willing to talk about it, see what's possible. And we ended up agreeing to terms that, you know, we ran all sorts of analysis, even drop rents for competing properties, you know, 10% in the event that the market does start to fall in the next year, and still couldn't even come close to achieving what we achieved on the renewal should we wait and move. So in those cases, we stayed and we did do something early. But I think you have to have an approach that's somewhat apathetic to what the landlord may or may not be willing to do if you're going to start those projects early. Do I think the market is going to start to continue to fall in industrial? Absolutely. I think the rents will start to come down. I still think there's movement in office space. You know, office has definitely been decimated around the country, but I still think there's further decline in certain instances. And I think that's indicative of what's going on in New York right now. So, you know, despite a challenging landscape that they're dealing with in Manhattan, and there are, don't get me wrong, signs of resiliency and recovery in Manhattan throughout the country, there's still a tremendous amount of product to work through. You know, there was an article in a journal last week about SL Green. And for those that don't know SL Green, they're the largest landlord in Manhattan. They own some of the nicest buildings in Manhattan. You know, they're making strides to lease about 2 million feet of space this year, and they're already at 1.4 million. So they're doing very, very well. They're trying to get back to give or take 90, 91% occupancy. But it's no smooth sailing. So, like, think of Manhattan, the largest office market in the United States, in a concentrated area. It still has 17.9% vacancy. And that's just down from the all-time high in history of 18.1%. So that market is flooded with 42.5 million square feet of office space that's been delivered since March of 2020. To give you an idea of how much space that is, if you take Amazon and their leased assets out of the Seattle market, it's just shy of the size of the entire Seattle office market. When I say Seattle, I mean downtown Seattle. So there's still a tremendous amount of Class A space available in Manhattan. And so I share all this. I'm not trying to, like, pivot to Manhattan, but the situation in New York serves as a microcosm for the national office market in some respects. And I think it highlights both the challenges and the opportunities that lie ahead for tenants, where there's just a tremendous amount of supply, no matter what product you're looking at, whether it be office or industrial. And there are instances where you can do something today and capture those savings and capture great deals, but there might be cases where we wait. But I think the genesis of this discussion here is that whether it be now or 12 months from now, it's going to be a tenant's market and one to do foreseeably awesome transactions, at least through the end of 25, in my opinion.
Hey, I want to answer Brian's question. If you're sitting on a large block, Class B office space, the time is now. Like, you're talking about landlords who can't afford to get back a big, empty Class B office building. So you mentioned 24, 25, 26, 27. 27 is just 3 years out. Time's down.
Yeah, sorry, I was specifically talking industrial, right? So this particular company. And to give you my answer of it, the answer is if you have a story to tell that builds a strategy around a multiple location scenario where you can make the case that you can consolidate locations, that is a powerful story for owners and their concern. And if you pick up and move to another building, they're faced with that all the time. But if you're a bigger company and you can build a strategy around a consolidation of your distribution centers or a consolidation of distribution centers, plus a change in your 3PL strategy that supports adding a new distribution center or changing the location of a distribution center, those get landlords very, very nervous, and they can't, when there's things that they can't solve for price, they want to try to lock you in quicker, is my experience, right? So in this scenario, is like, I think you'd be patient, but use all the levers you have, and levers that landlords cannot solve through pricing gets them very nervous that, you know, we're going to pick a location to renew in. It may be yours. It may be another one of our distribution centers. And we're going to pick it based on a lot of factors, and cost is one of them. So you're not only competing against the building next door, you're competing against the other owners in our portfolio, because you're all not going to get renewed, or you're not all going to be successful in keeping us as a tenant. And, you know, I like using strategies like that because it changes the conversation from you being just another tenant to being one that leverages your size and scale. And two, they're not just competing against, because their brokers who are, you know, market brokers that work on landlords are providing owners with comps on what is available. And Tucker, the strategy you used is perfect when it's available, right? And there's a building down the street. But I like to be able to layer in, if possible, more strategy and just another layer that says, like, you're not just competing. Your broker might be providing you information of the buildings around us, but you're not just competing with them. You're competing with our other owners across the portfolio, because you're not all going to be successful in retaining us. And it just creates another level of uncertainty and risk for ownership that hopefully leads to better outcomes for our clients.
Hey, can we pivot into office? We've talked a lot on this pod, or certainly I have, about the changing civic structure of downtown urban markets. Like, something's fundamentally changing from the days when all the jobs were in a downtown city center. Everyone lived somewhere else and commuted to go to their job at that desk in the downtown market. Something's changed, right? And then we've talked a lot about, in just the last pod, we compared the Back Bay Boston to the Financial District Boston. And Back Bay Boston's thriving because it's, you know, for first and foremost, it's clean and it's safe. That's what urban centers need. It's also then the full live, work, play complement. It's a cool place to be. As opposed to the Financial District, which just has office jobs and it's otherwise not as robust, and therefore the office markets there will languish. Okay, so we have third-party validation, I believe. This gentleman, Dror Poleg, who produces some really interesting pieces. I tend to follow him. And he wrote this article for The Atlantic. It's called "The Urban Doom Loop Could Still Happen." And some of the themes that he hits on, I think, are really interesting and reinforce what I've been trying to say for some time. So first, let me define, as he defines it, according to the doom loop hypothesis, reduced demand for office space would lead to a collapse in commercial real estate values, and in turn, a decline in city revenues and services, which would then push even more business and workers out of the city. That's the doom loop idea. And so here's kind of the thesis of this article. Historically, a booming economy has reliably translated into a booming commercial real estate sector. Now, however, San Francisco and other so-called superstar cities have entered a kind of Schrodinger's economy, booming and busting at the same time. I like that. City leaders must come to terms with the fact that pre-pandemic office demand is never coming back and plan accordingly, says Dror Poleg. Okay, two more things I'm going to read to you from the article. He does a nice little stages of grief thing here I'm going to read. Ever since the pandemic, many landlords, mayors, and bosses have been going through what one might call the five stages of office grief. First, in 2020, there was the denial that working from home would have any kind of a lasting impact. Then in 2021, there was anger at employees who wouldn't return, followed by bargaining on the exact number of days people would spend at the office. And by 2022, depression had set in and cities seemed ready to accept the need for radical change. Like that. Okay, here's his conclusion, and then I'm done and you can respond. Our cities will be better served by embracing the transition to a world that is less centered around offices. That will require diversifying their economic base, streamlining the construction and conversion of new housing in mixed-use neighborhoods, enhancing public services, and doubling down on what makes urban life attractive in its own right. not just as an employment destination. And the effort must start with the recognition that, in good times and bad, the relationship between economic activity and office demand has changed forever. I think he does a good job of summarizing what we've been trying to say. What do you think?
I think he's been listening to the podcast because we've been saying this for a year. And he just, you know, did the research and found the stats and is effectively taking our concepts and putting them on paper. Maybe, you know, maybe we should serve him with some sort of a cease
and desist. I don't see a source reference to the Corporate Real Estate Insider.
I you know, I'm a little concerned, but I think, Owen, you touched on New York. It's interesting. I was just talking to two different people, two different stories. One is he's looking, he just went to New York with his daughter, and he's looking for apartments and did a massive search around the city, and rents are through the roof and demand is very difficult. I was with another person who is doing exactly the same thing, actually, in Albany, New York. His daughter is going up there for school. No, for work. One's for school, one's for work. And had a real challenging time finding a high-quality location that's in a safe location. She's working, I think, at the hospital, in a safe location in a quality building, and effectively was shut out of the market in Albany, but got really lucky and went to the last building at the end of the day. Everything else was kind of full and a challenge, and they said, you know what, let's go try this one. They're not listing anything available, but you never know, and got super lucky and something was available, right? So it's interesting because the residential markets in these cities are full. We're seeing some of these residential buildings go back to lenders, and it's not because of occupancy and it's not because of rents. It's because they've been using real estate as a financing tool to create wealth for investors. And we've just been playing arbitrage, so the buildings are overvalued based on even full occupancy and rent growth. But, you know, a city like New York City that has really, really strong housing on both the residential and residential purchase and residential rental side has 600 million square feet of office space. And I think if you polled most people, half of it, no one will ever want to lease again. And so I think, you know, I think these downtowns are strong, I think, in certain neighborhoods that have a high concentration of really low-quality real estate on the office side are going to fall into challenging times, right? And New York is one of them. So it's interesting to see where we're going, but his conclusions are one that we've been talking about. Office space, for the good portion of it, is too obsolete to be reused and needs to be taken down and used as housing or redeveloped into housing. And that's, in New York, it could be hundreds of millions of feet.
Yeah, let's not just like hang on housing. I mean, this gentleman who wrote that article, John, I feel like, to something earlier point here, second with Brian, you know, sounds like he listened to our pod, but, you know, the resiliency of a downtown and the economic vitality of the downtown is really more than just office space, as the author mentions. And it's frankly more than just housing. You need to have a lot of retail, restaurant, think about entertainment, cultural institutions. All of that is going to add to this sense of draw that brings people into a city and helps it become, you know, a little bit more of a vibrant than that, which is like a daytime destination for office jobs. It also makes it a lot more sustainable. So, you know, think of the reduction of, you know, long commutes if people are living downtown or having to drive, you know, long ways to go see events and so forth. So lowering traffic, you know, helps with pollution as well. You care about, you know, the environment and that kind of stuff. And then it also, you know, like I think about what he was saying. I mean, as I think about Seattle specifically and the cities here in the Northwest, you know, years ago, I was harping on, you know, the lack of safety and security, and that's slowly changed and gotten a lot better in Seattle. But an active downtown that's busy during the day and night tends to be safer. You know, when you have continuous activity in the presence of people, that deters crime on its own, not necessarily with like adding more officers to the street. Just the activation of that downtown helps tremendously. And let's not forget the fact that, like, if these cities can come together not collectively, but like in the thesis of like creating better downtowns, it just helps the real estate value. You know, a lot of our operational budget for the city of Seattle and for every city for that matter has to do with real estate taxes and excise taxes and building sell. When you have a downtown where there's demand for living and working, among other things, it helps real estate values and increases the property tax receipts. So cities should be incentivized to, you know, create better downtowns through all these different medians for their own sake, just in terms of their operational budgets.
So maybe on a future pod, we can come on and give some examples of urban centers that are getting it right. Places like Back Bay, Boston, and highlight what they're doing right. That might be interesting.
I'll give you the answer real quickly. You need to have like, you know, 100 higher education institutions that drive some of the best technology or best minds in the world. You need to have an ocean on at least one side, but maybe two or three, to landlock the city so you can't build anywhere you want. And then you need to have a lot of other industries that have been here organically for hundreds of years. And you have to be the birthplace of the nation. And if you could put all those together, you would have a thriving downtown. And I say that fictitiously.
You're sounding like a coastal elite, bud.
You know, John, that's funny. You kind of took that full circle, but I would say I am a Boston homer. You know, they call it Beantown for a reason. It's the Senate, not Beantown, sorry. They call it the hub for a reason. And they call it Beantown too, but they call it the hub for a reason. That's short for the hub of the universe, right? That's how Bostonians think about our wonderful city. And we are very fortunate to have a lot of different economic drivers that
support it. So humble too. Humble.
You know, when you talk about our city, we are not humble at all. We think it's the best. I'll tell you a funny story, though. I was just talking to someone, and I don't know if I mentioned this on a previous pod, but they're in New York. I was trying to do their work here in Boston, and they were telling us about and this fits into the conversation, their search in New York. And I said, oh, have you looked in Hudson Yards? And this is for a large requirement. And they said, oh, no, we would never go to Hudson Yards. I'm like, well, that's where everybody wants to be. He goes, that's where everyone used to want to be, not anymore. That's just where the tourists go for retail. Like, what? He said, yeah, no, that's, you can't get there. It's not great. It's very expensive for people to live. All the retail is out of the price point of all of the employees I want to have. It's like the super luxury stuff. He said, that's the wrong image for our company. It's the wrong location. We're trying to get people back in the office, and we don't want to be way out there. So it's funny how quickly, this is a major user, how quickly, you know, the mindset can change around these neighborhoods too. If you don't have a long established kind of group of employers that have kind of built it, right? It's because for the longest time we're talking how great Hudson Yards were, and it's where everyone wanted to be. So we'll see if that continues to change, or if it continues to outperform the rest of New York.
Okay, well, I was hoping we'd be able to end the episode with Brian talking about how Boston is the center of not just the U.S. or the world, but in fact, the universe. But instead, we will have to end it there with John and Brian, and I guess the whole pod sort of clowning on Hudson Yards a little bit. Didn't expect that that's how episode 40 would wrap up, but that's where we will end. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening, and we will be back with another episode soon.